Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight for a discussion of 1990's Dick Tracy by the biggest dick I know, Adam Risky.
Back in school, people used to call me breathless on account of my asthma.
Hey, you should visit our website at fthismovie.net, and you should follow us on Twitter. We are at F This Movie. Go ahead and like us on Facebook, why don't you? And email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Hey, you know, I brought up Twitter and following us on Twitter.
Yes.
And you should really do that because just this week we announced the date for F This Movie Fest 3. It's coming
up on
February 15th. We're watching five movies from the year 1985 and talking about them over Twitter. It is the world's only Twitter film festival. This is our third year doing it. It is a ton of fun. You should all participate. Go to fthismovie.net for more details. Are you excited about it?
I'm very excited about it. I want to go on the record, too, of giving props to Doug, because I thought his poster
He does good work, doesn't he?
It was unbelievable. I'm looking forward to it. I've never seen Explorers.
Okay, I think that's going to be the hole in a lot of people's...
Yeah. I did not know it was a Joe Dante movie.
Is it
Dante's Peak? Close to the summit?
It's a weird movie because I wanted to watch it because it's Joe Dante and I'm honestly hoping to engage him on Twitter during it. Mm-hmm. But it's very flawed to the point where Joe Dante has basically said it's not finished. They put it out because the date came and they wanted to put it out, but I never was able to finish the movie. So it is a weird movie, but hopefully an interesting one for everybody watching.
Does Ethan Hawke fight with a little Julie Delpy?
He does, yeah. He actually fights with a little Amanda Peterson, who would grow up to be Cindy Mancini in Can't Buy Me Love.
Wow.
He doesn't fight with her either. He loves her.
As he should, I'm
sure. So we're going to be talking a little Dick Tracy action coming up shortly.
Was this the first time that you pulled out your dick in, like, 20 years?
Probably. Yeah. I might have watched it once when I got it on DVD, which was probably, what, like, 13 years ago? I don't remember when it came out. But.
So you unwrapped the shrink wrap around it and you fucking used it?
Wow. Wow. This is a Disney movie. But before we do that, Adam, have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, but before I get into what I've seen good lately, I gotta address America.
Oh, yeah.
You spent $50 million nearly on Ride Along this weekend, and you gave it an A Cinema Score. We saw two different movies.
Cinema Score is the worst.
It is, but I just...
But the box office you can't argue with.
But an A? For Ride Along?
Yes. That doesn't surprise me even a little bit. Its Cinema Score is worthless.
Okay. All right. I want to talk to you, but I don't think we've ever talked about Kevin Hart.
Maybe. Yeah. When his stand-up movie came out, we both were like, yeah, we like Kevin Hart.
I like Kevin Hart. I saw Grudge Match. He was funny in that.
Okay.
Grudge Match is better than it has any right to be. It's not good, but it's fine. So I was relatively excited about seeing Ride Along, being a Kevin Hart fan. And in fact, in the piece I wrote with Heath about the 2014 thing, one of the things that we cut out because the column was getting too long, but we predicted who was going to blow up this year, who was going to cross over into the mainstream. And one of my guesses was Kevin Hart.
Good guess.
But because I thought Ride Along was going to be his Rush Hour.
Right.
And I think it's more like his Rush Hour 3. Yeah. The thing that bothers me about Ride Along, especially Kevin Hart and Ride Along so much, is that he's doing his stand-up act, and he's not playing a character.
Right, right, right.
And he's got, and I'm noticing, he's got a very specific pattern of speech.
Mm-hmm.
It's stand-up talk.
Right.
Where it always is like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's just like that. And every part of his riffs in the movie are like that, and it just gets really flat and monotonous after a while.
Yeah.
And I knew we were in trouble when I was watching the movie, and in the opening credits, they showed four screenwriters.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, yeah, they improvised this entire thing, didn't they?
Yeah, you could tell that somebody was just like, go ahead, riff, Kevin.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's... it's just like really lazy and bad. And Ice Cube barely looks awake. And
I'm not a huge fan of Ice Cube, the actor. Like,
yeah.
In Boys in the Hood, it was cool because it was like, wow, that guy can act. And he did some good stuff in the 90s. And he's fine in like Three Kings. But
yeah.
He makes mostly garbage.
He's just another one of those comfortable rappers now where right, it's just kind right. of like, you're not what you were back then. And it makes sense because they grew up and that they matured and they became family men and stuff like that. Right. It's just like really sad to see. It's like if Tupac lived, would he have been in the pacifier?
He would have been Mace Windu is what he would have been.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that happened. Yeah, don't underestimate the popularity of Kevin Hart because I'm aware of Kevin Hart and I knew Kevin Hart, but I had no idea how huge he is until I found out he sold out Madison Square Garden like for 3 nights in a short amount of time. Like he's very, very popular. So I wasn't totally blown away that the movie did really well, but I'm bummed out to hear that it's garbage.
It's
better or worse than Cop Out. Cause I'm a fan of the buddy cop movie, as you know,
and
better
I
or worse than Cop Out.
I never saw Cop Out cause I heard
let's say better.
How terrible it was.
Yeah,
so,
it's not very good.
Ride Along was just, for as much as you can be disappointed by a movie that's released in January,
I was
very disappointed because I just wanted to go there, be entertained, have a good time.
Right.
And I laughed more at Kevin Hart in the About Last Night preview than I did during the entire movie of Ride Along.
What is Kevin Hart's best film performance, would you say?
Outside of Let Me Explain, which doesn't really count.
Right.
And then I've never seen Think Like a Man. I've seen Grudge Match. What are some of the other things?
He was the villain in Fool's Gold.
I've never seen Fool's Gold.
Oh, you're a better man than I.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't think of a movie where Kevin Hart really
was an awesome
actor.
Yeah, I don't think he can play a character, at least as of yet.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe.
So we'll see.
Right.
I don't know.
So what else besides Ride Along did you see?
I watched Life Itself.
Oh, yes.
Roger Ebert's documentary. They had this interesting way of watching it where if you donated $25 to a Kickstarter type of thing, you could stream it at the same time that they premiered the movie at Sundance.
Oh, cool.
So they did that yesterday, and I used my Hanukkah money and spent $25 on it. So thanks, Mom and Dad. So I watched the movie, and it's a tough movie to kind of judge for me because I can't tell if I can be objective about it
because
I really just care about the subject matter.
Right.
And almost anything about Roger Ebert would probably resonate with me to some extent. But with that being said, the documentary is based on his memoir, which I do not care for very much because it's something that you've talked about. It's we want to learn more about why you are important.
Right. Just
and
get
why
to the part where you made the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Exactly, exactly. So I'm happy to say the movie fixes all of those problems.
Okay,
it talks about him as an icon in the film criticism arena. It talks about how a lot of people did not like him because of the marginalization they said of film criticism that he did. And it's really funny because they have like Jonathan Rosenbaum from the Chicago Reader and like Richard Corliss from Time Magazine. And he references a column that he did for Film Comment where he took Siskel and Ebert to task. And it's so funny because they come off as just like the biggest wet noodles ever. And they're just like,
Jonathan Rosenbaum, a wet noodle?
Yeah. They're just like, these movies aren't from Poland.
Jonathan Rosenbaum was Armin White before it was cool.
Yeah, exactly. Freaking Armin White. He's available. You could probably get him for some shows now.
Yeah, I'm sure. He has horrible things to say about Ebert. He has said horrible things about Ebert.
Yeah. I don't know. But so it fixes a lot of those problems. Some really interesting things about Gene Siskel that I've never heard before, because for all the writing that is available from Ebert and about Ebert, there's a real like lack of that for Gene Siskel, surprisingly enough.
Yeah.
So there's one photograph that they actually show of Gene Siskel, and it involves him being at the Playboy Mansion. And it is one of the greatest pictures I have ever seen in my life. It's just something that you would never think to put together.
Okay.
So the movie itself is good. It's a tough movie to sit through a little bit, though, because they really get into the mortality aspect of Ebert. They show him a lot in the hospital. They show him getting his G-tube sucked out. And, I mean, it looks painful. And there's parts where it goes against things that he showed in his, that he kind of came across in his blog, where he was talking about being a fighter and surviving through the cancer. There's parts in the movie where they show him where he's very frustrated and he doesn't want to continue. And like Chaz Ebert, his wife, is kind of rallying him on. So it's a tough movie, but, it's really well made. It's good. It's not like a puff piece, but at the same time, I kind of almost want to have a Roger Ebert movie that I can have as like a keepsake to like go back to and watch and like be a documentary that I enjoy. Like,
right.
With the King of Kong.
Right. Exactly. Right. And just a fun thing about him and the world of criticism and like,
exactly. Yeah. And this is not that.
Right.
And it's probably in terms of quality better for it, exactly. But it's not going to be something I'm going to want to watch over and over and over
again. You want the Roger Ebert fan film.
Exactly. And this
is, a better documentary, but not, I totally understand. Yeah. Just you describing it. I'm like, oh, there's parts I can't wait to see. And then parts that will break my heart.
Exactly. But I'm looking forward to watching it again when it comes out.
Yeah, that's very cool. That just played at Sundance yesterday, right?
It did, yeah.
Look at you.
I know. Dirt off my shoulder. and then I saw Diner for the first time.
Interesting. Have you ever seen Diner? Of course.
So I had seen the fourth quarter of the Barry Levinson Baltimore quadrilogy, Liberty Heights, before.
Yeah.
That was one of those movies
where I saw that maybe in a theater.
When I worked at Blockbuster, it was one of my five free rentals for the week. and I remember liking Liberty Heights well enough. I'm sorry.
I remember nothing about Liberty Heights.
I remember Ben Foster being in it, and he like was listening to Sinatra, and some guy was in the car with him, and he said, "Sir, you don't get out of the car when Sinatra's playing." And it's just like, oh, why don't you go marry Robin Wright? So Diner, I really like some of Diner.
Yeah.
Some of it really bothers me.
Okay.
The parts that bother me are that you would get about 20 minutes of just like really interesting character stuff, and the movie kind of plays it where the guys are kind of cool, but they also like don't make them out to be, you know, perfect either. They kind of are douchebags, and the movie's aware enough to know that they're kind of douchebags.
Right.
And there's some really well-observed moments, like with Daniel Stern about his record collection and like yelling at Ellen Barkin, who just looks adorable in that movie. But then they have a lot of like contrivances that just really got in the way, where it's, you'd have 20 good minutes, and then you'd have, it's like, uh-oh, the Earl is eating the left half of the menu. Or it's like, uh-oh, it's like Kevin Bacon is naked and in the manger. We got to go get him. And it's that stuff. Or like you would have the requisite Mickey Rourke, I'm too cool for school scene.
Right.
Where it would just draw me out of the movie. But there was a lot to like in it.
Yeah.
And I want to keep going. I'm going to watch Tin Men and I'm going to watch Avalon. So
I wonder how much of that. I know Barry Levinson has said that a lot of that is based on him and his friends or whatever, and I wonder how much of it, I'm guessing those bigger, like, broader sequences that you're talking about, that's the stuff that doesn't come from his life. Now, I could be wrong, Barry Levinson will be like, no, my friend really was naked in the manger. Mm-hmm. But that the stuff that's really good is the stuff that's true to his experiences, and then he's like, oh, but I need some big, like, comic beat here.
Yeah, that was like the version of Finch shitting.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. I have not seen every Barry Levinson movie.
How dare you?
But I think I can pretty safely say that Diner is my favorite Barry Levinson movie.
Okay.
But I say that because I don't like a lot of Barry Levinson movies. I'm not what you would call a Barry Levinson fan.
Yeah.
No tolerance for Rain Man. Not a huge Good Morning Vietnam guy.
I like Good Morning Vietnam. Nah,
fuck that movie.
About Wag the Dog?
Wag the Dog is okay.
What about Sphere?
I never saw. I was just about to say Sphere, but I never saw Sphere.
Okay.
So, cool. Diner.
Yeah, so, right on. So Diner was pretty decent.
I had a first time viewing of The Gauntlet, which is like a mid-70s Clint Eastwood movie that he directed.
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never saw it, though.
It's kind of a cool movie. It's It's the original 16 blocks. he has to go pick up Sandra Locke, who's like playing, of course, a prostitute, and he has to transport her from Arizona to Nevada, or from Nevada to Arizona. And it turns out all these people are gunning for her. So by the end, there's armies of police officers firing machine guns at the bus that they are on. So it's kind of a cool movie in that way, in that kind of, you know, Clint Eastwood clearly picked up some stuff from Don Siegel working with him in the 70s, so it has that kind of a vibe. I would really love the movie if not for how misogynistic it is.
Okay.
Sandra Locke is essentially the only female in the movie, and she is a prostitute, and every character at one point just talks about wanting to have sex with her, what it would be like to have sex with her. One cop describes it in graphic detail, just harassing her, trying to rape her. Clint Eastwood clearly can't stand her, and I'm pretty sure they were in love or married at the time.
Yeah.
Clearly, their characters can't stand each other. He has no use for a woman, no patience for women at all. So it's kind of hateful towards women in that way.
Is it a Don Siegel or a Clint Eastwood directed movie?
Clint Eastwood directed it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was after Plain Misty for Me.
But yes.
That was sort of misogynistic, too.
Kind of, yeah. Clint Eastwood had some...
He had a run.
Yeah. And my guy was the 70s? I don't know. I don't know what it was.
Now he just does it in real life.
But kind of a cool movie if you can get past some of the sexual politics.
Yeah.
Then I watched a movie on Netflix Instant called Plus One, which... are you aware of Plus One?
No, it just sounds like a Gene Wilder pregnancy comedy.
I wish... What was that movie called?
Funny About Love.
Yeah. Is Mary Stuart Masterson in that?
Yes, she is.
Nice. Okay, so...
I saw that on vacation at Disney World.
Dang.
Shit!
That's how I saw Catwoman.
Oh, wow.
I was on my honeymoon. So Plus One, I knew nothing about, except Doug had featured the trailer months ago and was like, what the hell is this?
Okay.
That was the only... And all of a sudden it shows up on Netflix, and I said, oh, that's that crazy movie that Doug had the trailer for. It's this massive teen party. The main star is, like, the main bad guy from The Purge.
Okay.
That guy?
Yeah.
He's the star. And he goes
voted as best supporting actor in the Caspers.
It's this enormous teenage party, and already, like, it's total science fiction because it's the most elaborate. There's stages with lights and strippers. I mean, it's the most ridiculous, over-the-top teen party that doesn't exist. And so the premise, so you get a half hour of just teen party, just the half hour of that. Then all of a sudden there's this crazy electrical storm and there's a blackout. And when the lights come back on, everyone at the party has like a clone, but the clone is 15 minutes behind real time. So they're watching themselves 15 minutes in the past.
Okay.
And it only works because the movie plays this game where the party keeps like, everyone, let's go outside. So they all go outside, and then new party, clone party, shows up in the house. So they're totally unaware of it for, like, a lot of the movie.
So would clone party have to go outside?
Or? Yeah, okay. Clone party would eventually go outside.
Okay.
Except, it keeps happening. The blackouts keep occurring, and every time the lights come back on, clone party is a little bit closer in time. So at first they're 15 minutes, then they're 12, then they're 8. And it's like, well, what's going to happen when we're doubling up?
You might be trying to dissuade me, but this sounds actually more and more interesting to me.
It is So here's the thing. Talk about a movie with a cool concept that has no idea what to do with it.
No.
Literally, I don't want to spoil it. It literally just does that. For about 90 minutes. It's like, oh, and now they're 10 minutes away. Uh-oh, now they're 7 minutes away.
You were, like, tickling my Twilight Zone and for, then like, 30 seconds.
Right. I was cool so setup excited. Has no idea what to do with the setup. No, it spends 85 minutes with the setup, and then the last 5 minutes, what it builds up to, you're like, are you kidding me? What it leads to is the most ridiculous thing ever. And I'm pretty sure the only reason people will watch it is because it was sort of sold on this image of one girl sitting across from herself and they kiss. So that happens.
I'm slapping my head.
But just ridiculous. A cool concept and actually kind of well made, but just goes nowhere. I could not believe how many times it was willing to just repeat the exact same thing.
I can just imagine the filmmaker who made Plus One, like, on the edge of his seat listening to this. He's like, he's gonna recommend it.
Sorry, Plus One director. And then I've actually just been going back and rewatching Quentin Tarantino's filmography. So I'm through Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Four Rooms. We've talked about these movies a lot. Reservoir Dogs obviously is great, and it was a movie that really was a turning point for me when I saw it in, like, 92. I'm still a fan, although, discounting Four Rooms, it's probably my least favorite Tarantino movie, which isn't to say that I dislike it. Obviously, I love it. It's a lot rougher and, like, more crude than I remembered it being. I haven't seen it in a long time, but watching it now, it's like, oh, he would never do that now. And part of that is, you know, he was young. Part of it was budget, I'm sure. It makes me so happy in certain scenes how well he writes for certain actors and how good Lawrence Tierney is. And even Michael Madsen, who was the height of cool from based on that movie and then slowly kind of pissed that away. Not in Free Willy, of course. I know you're a Free Willy fan.
I just found out, speaking of Free Willy really quick, I just found out that Randolph from Free Willy died when I watched the SAG Awards.
Who, I don't know who that is.
He was the Native American gentleman.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I was too.
Yeah. I didn't even know there was a Native American in Free Willy. I've never seen Free
Willy. He's a gentleman.
But I, this time watching it, I felt like the acting was more uneven than I remember because
whose performances bothered you?
Tim Roth.
Really?
He's like,
okay,
really weirdly over the top, and it's a problem that would come up again in Four Rooms. But I had some problems with Tim, and again, I know what he's asked to do is like scream and die for much of the movie.
Yeah,
but his performance was more problematic for me than I remembered it being.
Important question for you about Reservoir Dogs, because I've never been able to figure this out. How does Tarantino die in that movie?
He's shot, but they never specifically say. I mean, somebody says the cops killed him. The car crashes. He's got blood in his eyes. Yeah. They step away for a second. They come back, and he's dead.
Exactly.
So maybe he had gunshot wounds that we were not privy to.
Okay.
The blood in his eyes was because he was shot in the head. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. It was just always one of those things where it would bother me like they forgot, like, an insert shot.
I don't think so, but I don't know. Pulp Fiction is great. It's Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. You know what's funny about that? Sometimes there's movies that are just so well regarded and movies that you love so much that like you feel like you can't go back to them.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like you got everything that you feel like you need to get out of it.
Right.
And I rewatched Pulp Fiction in a theater at the Portage like a couple years ago. They had like a free screening and it was great because they had like 500 people there just to see like a free screening of Pulp Fiction. And yeah, I just sat there and it's just unbelievable how effortless it all is.
Yeah.
That's the thing it's like putting on like a jazz album. I mean, like it just flows. There's nothing where you're like, oh, I really want to get past this hump because it gets to this really good thing. It's all you know, gravy train. It's just great.
It's hard for me to watch it. And I was tweeting about this watching it. It was like, oh yeah, I know every beat of this movie. It's been a couple of years since I'd seen it. So it was like, as it's happening, I'm remembering every line about half a second before it comes out. And it is a little bit hard to watch it and distance yourself from all the shit that came afterwards. And every aspect of that movie has been like parodied in pop culture and it shows up on The Simpsons or whatever. Yeah. I mean, everything, a line like "we're going to get medieval on your ass" is a great line, but it has no power anymore because it's been repeated so many times. So I feel like the power of Pulp Fiction has been sucked away a little bit by its popularity. And I don't mean that in a way that like, oh, everybody else likes it, now I don't. That's not what I mean at all. It's just that it's been filtered down and copied by so much other pop culture that it's hard to sort of recapture that pure experience of seeing it the first time.
Yeah, I know what you mean. One thing that always strikes me when I watch Pulp Fiction, and I don't think it's talked about a lot, is all the attention for performances really kind of went to Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, to a certain extent Uma Thurman, but I don't think Bruce Willis has ever been better in a movie.
I mean, Die Hard. It's hard for me.
It's close, but I mean, like, he's what I think people see in Steve McQueen that I never get out of Steve McQueen. Okay. Bruce Willis in that movie is just, like, the epitome of the cool anti-hero.
Yeah.
He's just unbelievable in that.
Yeah, no, he's definitely awesome in that movie. Yeah, for me, it's hard to top Die Hard. But it's cool to watch and remember Travolta coming back through that, because he's unbelievable in that movie. Just his comic timing in that movie is so great. And Samuel L. Jackson, I mean, that's a movie where you feel like you were discovering somebody for the first time. Even though he'd been around for a while, it was like, oh my God, who is that?
Yeah.
And again, that's been sort of ruined by him doing that same shtick in every subsequent movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Getting back to Travolta, I mean, like, it's funny because he's playing, like, a dumbass.
Right.
But he doesn't overplay the dumbass thing. He's just kind of...
Sleepy.
He's just like that schlubby, like, lazy piece of crap.
Yeah.
And he's just not very intelligent.
Yeah.
He's might be, like, a really good employee, but he's just, like, the person that you kind of have to explain things to, like, two or three times.
Right,
and he's just... Yeah, he just nails it.
So I could watch him on the date with Uma Thurman for an entire movie.
Yeah.
It's really, really great. And I'll say this, and then I'll get to Four Rooms. Four Rooms is garbage.
The like, wacky detective. How much money did that make?
72.1 domestic.
A lot of motherfuckers saw the wacky detective.
I have issues with that Tarantino segment.
Then you have issues with everything in Four Rooms.
Well, yeah.
That's the only good thing.
Yeah. Well, I used to think the Robert Rodriguez was actually...
I used to also.
It's not.
It's better than Machete Kills.
It is better than Machete Kills. The first two segments are just awful. I mean, I will always be fascinated by Four Rooms just for what it represents, this time in movie history and the 90s resurgence, or not the resurgence, the appearance of sort of this indie boom where Allison Anders and Alexander Rockwell could have movies distributed by Miramax.
So she was Gas Food Lodging.
Yeah, he was in The Soup.
Okay, I've never seen In The Soup.
You know, whatever. Yeah, all right. I know they've both made a few movies since. Like, she did Grace of My Heart, which is actually not bad.
Okay.
She might do some TV now. I don't know, and I don't know what happened to Alexander Rockwell.
Yeah. He changed his last name to Payne.
So it's a fascinating sort of snapshot of a time in history, but it's almost unwatchable as a movie.
Yeah.
And Tim Robbins is playing a different... It's weird to see him play a different character in all four things, because he's getting different direction from everybody, and I feel like he overacts horribly in all of them. The Tarantino segment is obviously, I think, the most watchable, but it's... Mm-hmm. show-offy in a pointless way that I don't feel like he usually does. It just seems like he didn't know what else to do, so he invents these camera moves that serve no function.
Yeah, I almost like it because it serves as like a time capsule of when he was kind of the worst.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of an admission of that.
Yeah, but it's like the Destiny turns on the radio, the episode of All American Girl, like that whole era.
That's the kind of shit that ruins Pulp Fiction, you know? But yeah, absolutely. And it's about that while at the same time still thinking that he's the best. You know what I mean? It's like, so it's interesting in that way. And I think it gets better as it goes along. And I think that last section where he's counting out the money and the timing of all the way that it plays out, I think it's pretty brilliant. I think all that stuff is really great.
Yeah.
And I'll say this, and then we can move on to Dick Tracy after a half an hour of What Have You Seen. This may be an unpopular opinion. I know he's not great in everything. I found him sort of distracting in Django Unchained. I enjoy Tarantino as an actor. And that may just be because I like him as a filmmaker. I find him interesting when he talks in interviews. He makes me nervous sometimes because he doesn't make eye contact, and he's a huge weirdo. But watching him in Reservoir Dogs, watching him in Pulp Fiction, even watching him in Four Rooms, I enjoy his acting. I hear people say he's horrible in Pulp Fiction. I have never thought that. I think he has really funny timing. I think... I really like that scene, if it wasn't for all the casual references to the N-word, which make me cringe, you know, way more.
Yeah.
I really enjoy his work as an actor.
Yeah, I think that he's not, you know, quote-unquote, like, SAG-worthy actor.
No, I mean, he should only play his own stuff. Exactly. You know? He knows how to write, but he knows how to deliver his own dialogue.
There's two, I see it, not to marginalize acting into, like, two categories, but I mean, like, you've got one style of acting, which is more genre acting, and you got one style of acting, which is more, like, your prestige acting, and I think that he's perfect for a genre-type acting role. And, like, I agree with you, I mean, like, I always... He's not great in Django Unchained, but he's not anything less than entertaining.
Yeah, no, he's fine. So. It just, the Australian accent throws me, and just having him show up, it pulled me out of the movie the first time. Yeah. And I believe it was sort of a last minute necessity because I think somebody else might have dropped out or not shown up or something.
Yeah, because I remember hearing something like Joseph Gordon-Levitt was supposed to be one of the three tracker guys.
I mean, that would have been distracting too. Yeah. You know, I mean, Jonah Hill's appearance is distracting.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I was getting nervous when the movie was being shot, and every couple weeks it would be like so and so showing up in Django Unchained, and I'm a little bummed out that the Kevin Costner stuff, which was Kurt Russell.
Yeah,
it was Kurt Russell, then Kevin Costner, then no one.
Yeah, they had a character named Ace Woody, and it was supposed to be Costner, then Russell, and then I think they ended up
it got folded into the Walton Goggins.
Walton Goggins, and the James Remar character, the second one.
Oh yeah, he plays too.
Yeah, the second James Remar character. But yeah, I mean, like, that's another one of those, like, kind of missed Tarantino opportunities, because I always kind of tying it to Dick Tracy, if you don't mind.
Oh yeah, nice segue.
I always thought that it would be interesting. I love David Carradine in Kill Bill, but I kind of still want to see the Warren Beatty Bill
right
a little bit.
Yeah
Not that I would trade it, right? But I mean, Dick Tracy.
So Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
Dick Tracy was your suggestion for a podcast.
Yes.
I watched the movie, and as I was watching it, I thought, that was a great suggestion for a podcast.
I thought so, too.
But because it was your recommendation, I'll let you take the lead on it.
Okay. Well, the reason why I wanted to talk about Dick Tracy was because it is a movie that you could talk about at length.
Yeah.
As a movie, and you could talk about it at length as a marketing thing.
Yeah.
And it's, I almost don't know where I want to start on it.
Let's start as a movie.
So when I talk about Dick Tracy as a movie, the way I'll describe it is when I saw Dick Tracy when I was 8 years old, I was expecting it to be Batman because that's what it was marketed as. It was the next Batman.
Absolutely.
And it was a movie that was really peculiar because it was something that was based on a comic strip from, what, the 30s or 40s?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was starring actors that I had no relationship with because I was way too young to be a Warren Beatty or Al Pacino fan.
Right.
Madonna even was a little bit ahead of my time. But it was from Disney. There was a kid in it. They marketed the shit out of the stuff about the little kid being in the movie to get the kid audience. There were toys. It was ridiculous. It was like, hey, kid, you should know this because this is like He-Man or like Ninja Turtles.
Right.
But it's this adult, like, crime movie in the package of a kid's movie.
Yes.
It's so that was really peculiar. So I saw it when I was young, and I did not get it. I was disappointed in it. I didn't think it was bad, but, like, I remember it wasn't Batman, and that's why I didn't like it.
Right.
I came back to it maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I liked it a lot more as an adult than I did as a kid. And then I gave it another, you know, few years, and then I just watched it again last night. And now my opinion of it is, it's like if somebody gave you a birthday cake, and they said you have to eat it all by yourself. So it's amazing for, like, the first few bites.
Okay.
But then you want to die after a while.
It is a mess, and I will apologize to those of you who love Dick Tracy, and I understand why people love it. My goal is not to tear it apart in, like, a mean way. Like, I'm not just going to say every aspect of it is shitty, but, like, it needs to be really taken apart because, oh my gosh, this movie's crazy. Everything you said, I totally agree with. I wanted it to be the next Batman. It was marketed. They had that symbol that was sort of like the Batman symbol, but it was just the silhouette of his head. At the time, the Barrington Square 6 Theater, which I believe it will be talked about later this week on the website, was showing it. And they didn't show first-run movies at the time, but they were showing Dick Tracy.
They did that with Disney stuff,
yeah, for some reason. As part of a special deal, and you could buy a t-shirt. And the t-shirt had, like, the Dick Tracy symbol on it.
Yep.
And that was, like, your ticket to get into the movie. And I was so excited about this, because not only could I get a t-shirt, but it was, like, a special ticket. So, mm-hmm. I honestly don't even remember if I did that, but I really was so excited about it.
Yeah.
I had the novelization. I had the Danny Elfman score on cassette. I had Madonna's I'm Breathless album.
As every child did.
Yeah. So I was super stoked to see this movie because Batman had me so primed from the summer before.
Yeah.
And like you, it was weirdly unfulfilling and disappointing. Mm-hmm. I didn't dislike it, but because I think I had convinced myself that I really did like it. So then when it came to the second run theater down the street from my house a few months later, I would keep going because I could get in and it was a movie that I could go see. And I kept trying to convince myself that I really liked it. Mm-hmm. But my goodness, what a crazy, crazy mess.
Yes.
Okay, let's start with the thing that everybody says is the thing that's good about it, right? The production design.
Yes.
Really cool. Done in all primary colors. Richard Silbert, really interesting production design. Mm-hmm. Some cool rear projection stuff.
Won an Oscar for best art direction.
Some sets that look fake in a good way, in that way that we really like as movie fans, where it sort of embraces the artifice.
Yeah.
And so I watch it, and I'm thinking, well, this doesn't look like any other comic book movie ever made, and that's to the movie's credit. But at the same time, I thought, but to what end? Aside from looking different, does the visual design of the movie really serve a function?
It's funny that you should mention that, because I agree with you half the way, and then the other half is where I divert from you. I disagree with you from the exteriors. I think the combination of the models with the matte paintings with the live action is really fantastic.
Yeah.
And I understand it's kind of to what end, but
no, all that stuff I like. I'm mostly talking about the color scheme.
Okay. Well, yeah, the color scheme, that's like this whole I'm going to put a pin on it until I start talking about the Warren Beatty direction, because that was one of his ideas, where he wanted it to be like the seven colors that were part of the comic strip, and that was it.
Right.
And it was part of his like dictatory way of directing, which was well documented during that production. So all that, I like it just from when I'm watching the opening credits of Dick Tracy, I'm beaming, because I'm just like, this is so cool to look at. And I was watching it on like a big TV and Blu-ray, and it was great. I was really excited, and you see the cast, and you just get in the Danny Elfman theme, and it
sounds
just
way too much like the Batman stuff.
I think the score sounds like the Batman stuff, but I think the theme is actually really good.
Okay.
But the problem I had with the set design is when you get to the interiors, like when they have a scene somewhere, it is so boring the way some of the stuff, like, not to kind of jump back and forth, but the final showdown, it's one of the most uninteresting places to have a final showdown that I could possibly think of. It's basically a dark room with like a rotating wheel that crushes things.
Well, again, it's the bell tower at the end of Batman. Yeah, I mean, it's almost the exact same, except it's a giant, clock factory or whatever it is, instead of a bell tower.
And the club is very kind of blah.
The whole sequence, not to jump to the end already, but when you think about the way that the movie resolves, all the bad guys get in their cars, drive out into the street, and are machine gunned all so at the same time.
It's so convenient.
Yeah, it's just people shooting machine guns at cars, and all the bad guys are dead. And the movie's over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know where to start with what's wrong with this movie.
Can I just say one thing about the ending? Al Pacino cracks me up in the end of this movie, because he's committed, like, he's been party to murders, like, the entire movie. But he keeps freaking out because
he's panicked because
somebody like set it up so it looks like he kidnapped Tess Trueheart, and he's just like, this is a federal offense. He's like this is a big problem.
Yeah,
like all the other stuff that he did.
Except he's more like, this is a federal offense. It's a big problem. And then 2 seconds after he says that,
yeah.
Dick Tracy says, it's a federal offense.
Exactly. So, I mean, yeah, he was right.
Right. But it's, you know, it's the irony. Because exactly. It's the one thing you didn't do is what you're going to get caught for.
You and I are going to disagree on the Al Pacino performance because I find it super entertaining.
I feel like Al Pacino watched Nicholson's Joker and said, that's far too subtle. Why is he underplaying everything? And so went so much further. And the crazy thing is, that's every Pacino performance now. Like, what he does in Dick Tracy is only that much more grotesque because of the makeup. Because take away the makeup, and that's exactly what he does in every fucking movie from 1990 till now.
Did you see that he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this?
You are kidding me.
No, I'm not.
Oh my god.
Because Dick Tracy was nominated for 7 Oscars. They were mostly technical.
Yeah.
And music. Al Pacino was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, a prize that was stolen from him by Joe Pesci in Goodfellas.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like at that point, Nicholson was really the first super respected actor after, like, Alec Guinness in Star Wars to take a property like that to sort of slum and take a movie like that and just, oh, look how much fun he's having. He's so cartoonishly over the top. It's the joy of performance. And now we're so beaten down by that because every actor has that shitty performance in a shitty movie.
Right.
Whatever. Al Pacino is not the worst thing in this movie, but it is symptomatic because here's the thing about this movie that I noticed watching at this time. It's 8 different movies.
Oh, and for sure.
Al Pacino is in one of them.
He's in the best version of this movie, I think.
He's in certainly the liveliest one. And there's a few other actors who are in his movie.
Mm-hmm.
I just, watching it this time, I was repulsed by so much of the makeup more than I was interested by it.
I was still interested by it.
Oh,
I think
they all look like they're melting.
I love the makeup in this movie.
Oh,
I wish more movies had makeup.
And I wasn't
like
watching
this.
It on Blu-ray. I was just watching it on DVD, but I felt like everyone looked like they were melting. A few of them work. I think Pacino's works, even though it's repellent to look at. I know it's supposed to be. William Forsythe's works, I think.
Yeah, William Forsythe's is great.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, my favorite character from a design perspective was always Flat Top. Mm-hmm. I thought he was the coolest looking one.
Yeah.
I had the Flat Top action figure along with the Tracy action
figure.
I think
he's used well in the movie. They use him just enough.
Just enough, and like his look, like he looks like
he's the Boba Fett of Dick Tracy.
He definitely is. That's a great call. Since we're talking about the makeup, one thing I think this just it makes me love the Al Pacino thing in this movie more. I read in the trivia on IMDb that apparently one time he was on set and that he was in full makeup and he was having lunch and he was eating pasta and it was melting the makeup. So they had all these makeup technicians who would like swarm in and fix his makeup. So like there were people who had jobs on the set to make sure that Al Pacino was not eating pasta. And I can just imagine
this movie went $30 million over budget.
I can just imagine Al Pacino just sitting at like a table, like eating a bunch of rigatoni, and he's like, "I love rigatoni.
Give me all you got. Give me all you got."
He's just like, "Love that chicken, bro."
Oh,
potty, potty.
Oh my god. All right. So one of the big problems with the movie, I think, is I would be interested in seeing a Warren Beatty directed Dick Tracy starring someone else, Warren Beatty.
And that could have happened several times because they were trying to cast it with another actor.
Yeah.
And then he just said, "Hey, I'll do it."
Right.
And he just kind of took the reins. Warren Beatty, to me, is one of the most smug actors imaginable. I love him in Bonnie and Clyde.
Right.
He's funny in Bullworth.
Okay.
I've never seen Reds.
Okay.
Bugsy bothers me a lot.
Barry Levinson, see?
Oh, man. I forgot. I always thought it was Warren Beatty who directed the movie, too. But he is just so self-satisfied. And I think that comes across in, like, every moment that he's on screen in Dick Tracy.
Yeah, well, he has a weird performance style. And he's one of those guys who I think is more an interesting personality in terms of his relationship to the industry than he is an actor. Robert Redford is sort of the same way. That especially the things that they were doing in the 70s, Warren Beatty for the 60s and 70s, were great in terms of what they were doing for filmmaking.
Yeah.
But I've never loved either one of them as an actor. And Warren Beatty's best performances are the ones that play what he does against him in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So Bonnie and Clyde, I think, does that. Shampoo, I think, works because he's playing just an idiot bimbo philanderer.
Mm-hmm.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is my favorite Warren Beatty performance, very much turns that sort of against him. But he's 100% wrong to me for Dick Tracy, because he's giving that same weird sort of mumbling performance that he's always given. And I'm not somebody who has tremendous affection for Dick Tracy. I didn't read the comic strips growing up or whatever, but I definitely have an idea of what the character should be.
Yeah.
And it's not Warren Beatty, who's just a weird mumbling, like, simp.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the authority. And, you know, later in the movie, it gets into he's cheating on his girlfriend. He wants to fuck Madonna. And it's like, that's not Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy is so by the book. I don't want a fucking flawed Dick Tracy. I'm not interested in exploring his flaws.
Okay, like, Warren Beatty in Dick Tracy, I think, I don't have as much problem with his performance, I think, as you do. I don't like him as a screen presence all that much, for the most part. However, from what I understand of the comic strip, and I never read it, but what I read about is that he's kind of the calm where everything else around him is crazy.
Right.
So he's supposed to be, like, the boring one, and everything around him is the stuff that's colorful and kind of over the top and silly.
Okay.
So I think if with that in mind, he is boring. So that makes
Isn't it supposed to be boring in, like, a square way? Not boring in, like, a half-awake way? Like, there's a difference between boring and bored. And I think Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy seems bored.
He seems aggravated. Like, I have to direct this movie. I don't want to act in it, too.
And so then other people are trying to pick up the slack around him, and just Al Pacino is barfing up his lung and inhaling plates of spaghetti as his makeup melts.
Al Pacino is a godsend to this movie. He's not even, like, great in this movie, but, no, like,
he's definitely not great in this movie.
If you take out Al Pacino in this movie, you're left with Warren Beatty and fucking Madonna.
Yes. All right. So let's get to Madonna in a second. But you had said something earlier that was really interesting, because in 1990, I think I knew who Al Pacino was just because I was aware that, like, there was this movie called Author from the back of the TV guide. I didn't really know, you know what I mean?
You know, Al Pacino from Author.
From the little picture that says Author is going to be on this week, because I would just study what was on.
Sure.
Warren Beatty, Madonna was probably the one I was most familiar with.
Yeah.
And so there's all these actors in this movie that just meant nothing to me. And now you watch it and you're like, Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
James Caan shows up.
Yeah, and you're like, Michael Corleone is talking to Sonny Corleone.
Right. And
it's
there's,
like,
right,
there's
and
three
these weird
people from Bonnie and Clyde.
Yes, yes. And right, all these weird inside jokes, sort of.
And Gene Hackman was supposed to be in Dick Tracy, but he turned it down because he said, after Reds, he would never want to be directed by Warren Beatty ever again.
Well, who could blame him?
Yeah.
Yeah, so now you watch it, and everybody is this great character actor, and so you can enjoy it just on that level.
Yes.
Unfortunately, they are all sidelined so that we could spend all of our time with Warren Beatty and Madonna.
All right.
So let's go there.
This is part of the Madonna thing, but I want to talk about it because it also ties into the music later.
Okay.
This movie has, I never remembered this until this most recent watch. This movie has more montages to the Stephen Sondheim written Madonna songs than, like, Rocky IV has montages.
Yes.
There's so, and it's just such garbage, because by the time you see the third one, you're just like, this movie is completely run out of ideas, oh, and I just want it to end.
See, and I won't even hate on the montages only because things sort of happen. I mean, not really. It's like, here's a montage where the crime runs rampant. Right, and here's a montage where Dick Tracy's cleaning up the town.
Yeah.
But think about the spaces between the montages. Mm-hmm. It's just like boring dialogue scenes of Warren Beatty stumbling through dialogue in a diner with Glenn Headley, who was supposed to be Sean Young.
And, but she wouldn't fuck Warren Beatty. No,
that's, right, that's her claim.
Yeah.
And Charlie Korsmo, who...
wouldn't fuck Warren Beatty.
who I'm just not a fan of, and it's not his fault. Maybe it's residual Hook anger. But I don't like any movie with like a precocious kid.
Yeah.
I just watched The Perfect Weapon for the first time, and that has a precocious kid, and he's played by that fucking Rufio. Talk about residual Hook anger. Anyway, I don't like the precocious kid, and they just call him Kid, and there's a whole scene where he says, "When do we eat?" over and over again.
Yeah,
and
it's, but that's funny, because he's...
He likes to eat. Hungry. Right, I don't know. Why. What's the joke there? He wants food? Okay.
Like, originally, it was supposed to be, "When can I bathe?"
So... right, montages, okay. Yeah. I we'll come back to like music, the music, I'm sure. Okay, I like the music.
Okay. Madonna.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus.
Okay. All right. Madonna makes sex lame. She is so unappealing when she comes on to people, which is all she does in Dick Tracy.
Yeah, that's my problem more than anything. I think, you know, 1990 Madonna is sexy, and I think... she can be sexy in this movie, but again, she's in a different movie from everyone else.
And well, she's playing Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity or like...
But it doesn't belong in this
Marilyn
movie.
Monroe.
Who is this movie for? It is ostensibly a children's movie.
Yeah. And they show her tits in the, the first time she comes on screen. I'm like, I'm not... imagining this, am I?
It's
this
is a children's movie where all she does is speak an innuendo about how she's great at fucking.
Yeah.
And it stars a bunch of actors who were popular.
Pussy. Do you remember that line where she's talking about she's just like, it's peach and it's dripping. You better get it. And I'm just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. They knew how to write innuendo in the 1940s. Madonna doesn't know how to do innuendo. She just speaks the text. It stars a bunch of actors who were popular 20 years earlier. I don't know who this movie is for. This movie is for like a 50-year-old man in 1990 whose dad read Dick Tracy. Like, I don't know. So whatever. Because when Madonna comes on, I'm like, how is this a PG movie? She's practically naked and everything she's saying is fucking filthy.
Yeah.
She hijacks this movie 100%. This movie becomes the Madonna show.
It really is.
Yeah. Nothing about Breathless Mahoney is interesting. Mm-hmm. Nothing about it really belongs in the movie. Again, her subplot about how Dick Tracy wants to fuck her is not interesting to me because it feels like a betrayal of the character.
Mm-hmm. Her no-face thing doesn't go anywhere.
My God, is that lame? That is terrible. The only thing she contributes is that we have, like, a character who's a showgirl, and they do the songs. And I like the songs. I think they did a good job approximating songs from that period. I think they're mostly catchy, as long as you don't listen to the album version where she duets with Warren Beatty.
Oh, man.
The fact that Warren Beatty wanted to fuck Madonna so badly really screwed up Dick Tracy, I think, because he put her in the movie way too much. There's way too much stuff about how he wants to fuck her in the movie like he does in real life. I think it really, really clouded up what he otherwise could have accomplished. She hijacks this movie.
Yeah, she really does. I don't like the music, but it's not, it's almost not Dick Tracy's fault, because I feel like ever since then, it's like Christina Aguilera has tried to be like Breathless Mahoney.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So like, I'm just used to this style of music that I don't like, where it's like USO show, but slutty. And it's just like, I don't care. But yeah, I just, nothing about Madonna, to me, is interesting as an actress.
Yeah, I've seen her in stuff that I think she's okay.
Like, Desperately Seeking Susan, but that's not it.
I like her in A League of Their Own. I think she's fine in that movie.
She survives it for me.
She doesn't, steal the movie, because Gina Davis is in that movie. Who's going to steal a movie away from Gina Davis?
Lori Petty?
No, no.
She steals everything, including America's hearts. Damn it.
So all the Madonna stuff is problematic, except for the fact that it affords the movie an opportunity to also be sort of a musical, and the musical stuff I like more than you. Mm-hmm. It stops cold at one point so she can sing a duet with Mandy Patinkin, who's singing the saddest song ever and just literally staring at her. And I don't know what's going on in his head when he's, is he in love with her? Is that what we're supposed to take away? Just that he's desperately in love? Did Mandy Patinkin need his own subplot going on in this movie?
Not really, no.
So the movie can stop where he just longingly stares at Madonna, who has fucked everyone in this movie.
Yeah.
And the scene where Pacino follows her around on stage and, like, smacks her and just yells about the choreography to that song, it goes on for an interminably long amount of time.
When I saw that scene, it reminded me of Showgirls, like, where they're yelling at all the showgirls about, like, pumping their crotches in the air higher and higher and higher.
I think the point of the scene is to A, show that he's micromanaging, and B, show that, like, he slaps her.
Yeah.
But it just goes on so long because I feel like Warren Beatty was just in love with the idea of, like, Al Pacino acting out a showgirl routine in crazy makeup with a performance dialed to 11.
If you've seen Jack and Jill.
I have.
It's not that different from his Dunkachino thing at the end of Jack and Jill. Really,
that's the best thing in that movie. And I found out afterwards, when I heard the lyrics, I thought that was written by Robert Smigel, and it 100% is written by Robert Smigel.
Nice.
All the references that they do to the Pacino stuff is almost funny. Now listen, maybe it's just finding a big gulp after crossing the desert. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing in that movie that I thought, okay.
Yeah, there's things, I don't know why we're talking about Jack and Jill, but like when he calls him like popcorn and stuff like that, I laugh.
Does that happen earlier in the movie?
I think so.
Okay, then no. Yeah. Nothing that happens before the Dunkachino rap is any good. Back to Dick Tracy.
Exactly. What do you think of, were there anybody in the cast that kind of stood out to you other than
as being
that?
Good?
Yeah, or like interesting or character-wise, like Mumbles or...
No, I do not like Dustin Hoffman's whole performance. And again, it just feels like Warren Beatty got a bunch of his friends to come do this.
Yeah.
And just everybody's sort of impressed with the idea that like, hey, Dustin Hoffman's in this crazy comic book movie. And he's doing this hilarious performance where he mumbles. Dustin Hoffman's makeup was more distracting than most for me because he's under that lamp and he's sweating.
It looks like it's falling off.
It really does look like he's melting, and I found it disturbing.
Yeah. I gotta say though, like, kind of, because I'm shitting on Dick Tracy a lot right now.
Me too.
I really do enjoy the first 30 minutes or so of it, but then it just really wears me out quickly. And it bums me out because the thing is, and I'm going to draw a parallel, and it might drive you crazy, and it'll probably drive a lot of people crazy, but I want you to hear out the full idea before you turn this off or pause it or yell at me. All right. Gravity is a much better movie than Dick Tracy.
Adam Risky F this movie.
But a big problem I had with Gravity, for me, and I'm just saying for me, was the look of it, the visual aesthetic of it, only works for me for a certain amount of time, but then when there's not something there connecting me to the story, I check out.
Okay.
And I just can, and all I can think about is why is this not working for me?
Okay.
And I have the same thing with Dick Tracy, where it's, I'm really caught up in the design of it, but then I realized that this movie, and not that it has to be about something, because it's Dick Tracy, for Christ's sakes.
Right.
But it's really not about anything.
It's not about anything.
There's no story, really. It's just Al Pacino wants to take over the town, but it's not even really about that.
Dick Tracy wants to stop him. But it's essentially about 2 hours of wheel spinning.
It's just like about behavior, but it's not like well-observed behavior.
No.
It's just a bunch of stuff happening. And when I realize that, I immediately just get severed from a movie, and it just becomes, as you said, to use a word that you used earlier, interminable. It's just like, when is this going to end?
Warren Beatty seemed to have an idea of how he wanted to make a Dick Tracy movie, and he knew how he wanted it to look.
Yeah.
And I feel like everything kind of stopped there. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we can applaud the way that this movie looks, and the production design is incredible, and a lot of the photography is good. I mean, I like the shots that sort of call attention to themselves as looking like a comic book panel. There's one very specific shot where there's a, he's got a can of chili and it just says chili and it's way up in the foreground and then the background is still in focus and it looks like a comic book panel. He does that a few times, but then a lot of times he loses interest in that. And so we just get coverage of people sitting at a diner.
Yeah.
But the story is problematic. And again, I feel like the best point of comparison for this movie is Tim Burton's Batman, mm-hmm. which is a movie that I loved in 1989 and have since, you know, grown colder on to the point where now I'm just like, it's a mess. It has a ton of problems.
Yeah, I can't watch more than like 5 minutes at a time of Batman.
But a lot of what it does, to me, it at least is more coherent as a piece than Dick Tracy. Yes. In terms of, well, why does Batman look this way? Okay, well, there's a reason. Mm-hmm. As opposed to Dick Tracy, which is like, because there was a comic strip and I wanted it to look like a comic strip. Well, okay, but now you also need to create a world that sort of matches that. The story is a little bit more streamlined in Batman, and it's like, well, Batman wants to stop the Joker, but at least there's stakes in that the Joker is going to kill everyone in Gotham and Batman has to stop him. Mm. What Big Boy wants is just sort of this vague run a club, be a criminal, you know?
Yeah, he just wants to, like, kind of run the town
over. We see him murder Paul Sorvino, who's also a gangster, so we're not really that concerned, and he slaps Madonna in the face.
Yeah.
Which, it also turns out, she's a criminal and a murderer, so okay. Yeah. But we don't necessarily see Big Boy doing damage to the regular people of the city.
Right. And it's also really weird how, for a Disney movie that's rated PG, how it's not violent, because it's all, like, you know,
bloodless violence.
Yeah. But just in attitude, it's so just, like, adult and ugly.
Yeah, this is a movie for Noah. It's 12 different movies. It looks like a children's cartoon. It has a very adult, ugly subtext running through it. Madonna's in a porn.
Yeah.
Al Pacino is acting out some crazy fantasy of his. Warren Beatty is asleep. Glenn Headley, you know, bless her heart, is boring. And I can like Glenn Headley in the right movie.
Like what?
I'm trying to think of one. Yeah. I'm sure there's one.
Don John.
You know.
I don't know.
She comes across as boring, and she shouldn't be. Our heart should go out to her. Like, we need to sympathize with her. Mm. And by the way, not because Dick Tracy wants to fuck someone else, because that's the wrong movie, but because, like, he won't commit, right? Yeah. And that's a fun little 30s kind of screwball thing that they could have going on, but not in this movie. Because, again, there's a way to do this movie that respects sort of the comic book origins. Like you said, it doesn't have to be about something, but it can certainly present an attitude and a worldview that is in keeping with that. I shouldn't point to this movie, but I will. Did you ever see The Phantom? The Billy Zane, Phantom?
Yes.
The Phantom is a really good example of what some of these other movies, I think, should be. Mm-hmm. And we differ on The Lone Ranger. I wish The Lone Ranger had been a little bit more like The Phantom in its approach. Dick Tracy should be more like The Phantom in its approach. That's a movie that knows what it is, that respects the material, that takes the right attitude in presenting it. It's still, like, fun and entertaining and all that.
Yeah.
Because Warren Beatty gets on board and all of a sudden it becomes this weird gray area movie from the 70s when he was making these interesting movies that could do that stuff, but it doesn't work in this.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I feel like, especially in a genre entertainment movie, where it's not, you know, trying to aspire to be any type of, you know, important piece of cinema. You can use templates that have worked before, like what you were saying, you know, with your example with The Phantom. I mean, The Phantom is, in many ways, it's using an Indiana Jones model.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like your adventure story in an exotic location.
Right.
I mean, like, I remember, do you remember, like, the live-action version of The Jungle Book from, like, the mid-90s?
I never saw it.
That movie worked because it just is an Indiana Jones movie.
Right.
And, like, Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, that works because it's just trying to be a Mission Impossible movie.
Right.
And, yeah, so, like, I completely agree with you. Like, Dick Tracy just needed to be just something kind of like, I'm trying to think of, like, a fun cops and robbers type of movie.
Right.
That is...
And that's sort of the movie that Al Pacino is in.
Yeah, that's, like, not gritty.
Right.
It's just kind of fun.
Right. And that is sort of the movie that Al Pacino is in, and that a couple of the actors are in. The problem is that nobody else is in the same movie. So Warren Beatty is doing his weird 70s thing while Al Pacino's trying to make a big cartoon, and Madonna is stuck in 1990 trying to do 1942. Right.
Yeah.
The movie that... I don't think Dick Tracy is a very good movie, and again, I know a ton of people have affection for it, and maybe it's because of when they saw it in 1990, or maybe it's just because we all respect the chances that it took in its visuals, and I can applaud that. Roger Ebert, I think, gave the movie 4 stars, and he was always a sucker for a visual design.
Exactly.
He gave Spawn 3.5 stars, like, because he liked the visuals, you know? And by the way, garbage visuals in Spawn, but whatever.
Talking about it looks great on Sega CD.
So I can understand what it was that he was responding to, and it is a movie that looks like no other.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a bad movie. The movie that kept popping up watching it this time was Robert Altman's Popeye.
Okay.
That it's two guys from a specific time period trying to take some sort of pulp source material, you know, that was aimed at kids perhaps, and elevate it into this other thing while still disguising it as being pulp kid stuff. You know what I mean?
And I have that same thing with Ang Lee's Hulk.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's the same thing where they're trying to make it more heft.
Right.
Give it more heft than it really needs to have.
And so while I think all of those movies in varying degrees kind of fail as movies, I'm glad they exist. Like, I'm glad this Dick Tracy exists because it's fascinating and it's unlike anything else. And same with Altman's Popeye and same with Ang Lee's Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
We got a more straightforward take on the Hulk a couple years later.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's not great, you know? Like, exactly. Maybe that's all we're going to get. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm going to say something, though, that, like, I want to get your take on it. I think it might be an unpopular opinion. I would rather see comic book movies in the way that Dick Tracy was made, or I'm thinking, like, The Crow. I would like to see comic book movies made in that vein more than the comic book movies that we're getting now.
In terms of taking a hard stance on the visuals?
I think where it's just more aware of its origins and it's not trying to be as realistic or, like, take place in New York City.
Right.
Or something like that. Because the thing is, these movies, as messy as they are, and almost all the 90s comic book movies are terrible from, like, a screenplay perspective, but they're very interesting, and I think they'll last longer in, like, the annals of film history, because they are just so specific in their looks, whereas with the movies that are being made now, the comic book movies, they're just either so of their time, or they're just such, like, a product in a different kind of way than they were back then.
Yeah, because they become so commodified and they're so commonplace now that people don't feel the need to, you know, when Warren Beatty sits down to make a comic book movie, those movies were so few and far between that everybody's first impulse was like, well, we have to pay tribute to the visuals of a comic book. We have to make this look and feel like a comic book. And they were all very conscious of that. Tim Burton did it with Batman. Even Rachel Talalay does it with Tank Girl. I mean, like, they were really paying attention to that. Joel Schumacher does it in Batman Forever. Yeah, and, you know, less so in Batman and Robin. But now every fifth movie is a comic book movie. So you don't really have to do that anymore. Now comic book movies just look like every other action movie, sort of.
And also, they, in many ways, have replaced the action
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, well, for sure.
Which
yeah.
is the thing that bums me out the most about them, and I think the reason why I resist them so much. But
we're so accepting of those movies and of superheroes now that we don't need them to distinguish themselves visually. Like, it was almost a a way of distancing the director or whoever from the material by saying, well, we know it's a comic book, so it's going to look this way. And I'm not, I agree with you. I would much rather they take, take a position just on the way that it looks as opposed to just this generic.
Right. One thing, you and I, like we've mentioned that we differ on the music in Dick Tracy, but Dick Tracy kind of, when I was watching it, it made me nostalgic for the era of the soundtrack.
Sure.
There was so much of that going on in, like, the early 90s, especially, where, like, and it doesn't have to necessarily be, like, a single artist kind of dominating a soundtrack, like a Madonna or, like, a Whitney Houston for The Bodyguard or something like that. But I just feel like it was part of the experience.
Yes.
And a lot of times, you know, it worked out really well, and it gave the movie a lot of personality, not to go back to The Crow, but I mean, like, that, I think, works better as a soundtrack than it works as a movie.
Sure.
And a lot of that has to do with, because of the energy and the mood that, like, those songs by The Cure, by, you know, Nine Inch Nails adds to it. And I feel like a lot of stuff with the summer movies of now, they don't have that because you've got your, you know, generic, like, Tyler Bates score to everything.
Right.
It's just kind of, you know, like, I'm going to press this button, and I'm like, here's your score. And, I don't know. I feel like we had it really good back then in certain ways, and that's one of the ways where, I don't know.
Maybe that, like, and that could just be our nostalgia
talking. I don't think it is, because, like, I'll go back and listen to these soundtracks.
Sure.
And it's still enjoyable to listen to, and I'm not thinking of it from, like, a nostalgia perspective. I'm thinking of it as, like, On Our Own by Bobby Brown is still a fucking kick-ass song.
But there is something to the to watching a movie, and this would happen more so later on when you can really tell that marketing departments were involved and all that kind of thing. You know, when you rewatch a Godzilla, not that you ever should, but the way that the songs are sort of shoehorned into the movie, to me, that always pulls me out when it's like, oh, I can tell that they're just trying to build and sell a soundtrack.
I see. Okay.
I don't get that from movies when I watch them in the 80s, and that's probably because those two things were just of a piece for me. There was the soundtrack, there was the movie, they work in conjunction with one another.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I mean, growing up, I was not way into music. That didn't happen till later, and now I'm not into music at all. But growing up, I had, like, a cassette collection.
Yeah.
Only soundtracks. That's all I listened to were soundtracks. And some scores, especially Danny Elfman, for me, was, like, the inroad to, scores. And so I would buy Danny Elfman scores.
Yeah.
And the I'm Breathless album always bugged me because it was music from and inspired by, and it was that inspired by caveat that pissed me off because Vogue came off that album, and Vogue is a garbage song, and so you can't even listen to the soundtrack and be, like, put back in the place or the time period because Vogue is so out of period that it was a distraction for me.
Yeah, I hear you.
Take that, Madonna.
Stupid.
So, will you go back and watch Dick Tracy again?
I think I will at some point before my time is up.
This was the least I ever liked it.
Interesting, okay.
I always had this weird residual affection for it because I saw it in 1990. I tried to will myself to like it. I thought I kind of did. It looks different than any other movie, and I've always appreciated that. It's only now that I'm like, yeah, but why? Why do that?
Yeah, I think that, well, my least, I've seen it three times. My least favorite time watching it was when I was 8. Now this was, like, my most recent watch was number 2. And then the one that I watched it, like, 5 years ago, I think at that time I was just really happy that something that I watched when I was a kid still kind of worked. And it wasn't, like, a big letdown because I've gone back and watched, like, Ninja Turtles from 1990, and
that's a mistake.
Yeah, I
there's very little art there. At least there's art in Dick Tracy.
Exactly. It's like, I shouldn't have done that.
I liked it on the
Robin
level.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. That's, like, rough going back to It's tough to do that.
That was another movie I think I might have convinced myself I liked in 91. And it's... That movie's not great.
It's very rapey and weird.
Yeah. Liked seeing all the actors this time. And maybe it's just because it's the first time that I've ever really tried to articulate, like, what is going... Like, what's the problem with this movie? Because I always had a weird just feeling in my stomach, like, something's off, but I don't know what. And this was the first time I ever really said, like, oh, it's this and this and this and this.
Yeah. F this movie has greatly added to my life.
By ruining movies.
But in certain ways, there are times where, like, I don't have even a mental checklist anymore. I have a checklist on a spreadsheet when I have at home. And whenever I write a review or consider a movie when I'm talking about, when I have to talk about it,
yeah,
I put it through the 15 marks, and I think about all these things.
Okay.
And, yeah, Dick Tracy did not really go. It went through basically, like...
You're going to have to write a column on, like, what the 15 are.
I don't want to give away my secret.
Well, yeah, I understand.
Yeah, so, it's basically, like, if you had, like, a great Lou Malnati's pizza, and then you put it through the 15, and then it comes out, and it looks like that goulash thing that, like, Josh Brolin's feeding Kate Winslet in the trailer for Labor Day.
What? Let's do a whole podcast on the trailer for Labor Day.
Have you seen the trailer for Labor Day?
Yes. What is going on in the trailer for Labor Day?
Yeah, he's just like, that's a good peach.
Oh my gosh. It's embarrassing. Like
when Heath wrote that he was like looking forward to it, yeah. I love you, Heath, but like when I saw that I was just like...
And I understand that he's looking forward to it.
I don't know what to say to this. I'm like, I disagree.
But well,
and I love Jason Reitman movies.
Exactly, Jason Reitman, Kate Winslet, Josh Brolin. So I understand why he's looking forward to it on paper. It wasn't until I saw a trailer that I thought, has Jason Reitman just lost his mind?
Yeah, what is that?
The reviews are terrible. I mean, there have been a bunch of reviews so far, and they are very terrible. So I guess this is his first real stumble, although a lot of people didn't like Young Adult either.
Once I heard the Tobey Maguire narration, I'm like, oh, this trouble.
Yikes.
Trouble in Jason Reitman'sville.
Anyway, so thank you guys for listening. Sorry if you're big Dick Tracy fans, and we ruined it for you.
You know what? I can't apologize for that. Like, here's the thing. If I'm going to go on like my soapbox for one second. Okay, I'm sorry, but I lost a friend once because I made fun of Ghostbusters, and I love Ghostbusters, but I made fun of it because I did, like, a stupid voice and sang the Ghostbusters theme, and he got so mad at me that he, like, stopped talking to me.
That's weird.
Well, he's crazy, but to a smaller extent,
yeah.
You have issues with Silver Linings Playbook. It's my favorite movie. If you tell me that, I don't get mad at you.
Yeah, right.
Because
right.
It's your opinion, and it doesn't take away from my liking of the movie.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think we're going to lose any listeners because we don't like Dick Tracy.
I'm just saying, like, if you feel that way, like, I'm sorry, but grow up a little bit.
Well,
just
right.
Like a little bit.
Right. It's okay because everybody can still like Dick Tracy. Yeah, the only reason I say like that, Tracy, the only reason I say that is because it would break my heart sometimes when I would open the Friday paper and Roger Ebert gave Batman 2.5 stars.
Well, you because I him, so, so you won.
I so wanted him to like the thing that I didn't even see yet, but I wanted to like. You know what I mean? So when you have, if you're a fan of this movie and you're a fan of Dick Tracy, you want the show that you like the movie that you like. That's all I mean.
Yeah.
And so when you turn it on and we're like, ah, fuck Dick Tracy, fuck Madonna. sometimes it's like, oh, that's too bad. We disagree.
Exactly. And I
nobody's going to quit over it.
And I like some of Dick Tracy.
Yeah,
so
me too.
So you can like some of the show. Exactly.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
I love brown chicken. I want pasta. Pasta. Give me more pasta. I want Ron to make up.
Pasta. Pasta.